Now on with business. After pleasure, business. We have a rather curious subject this morning that I think has some timely implications. It has to be sort of reinterpreted, however, because actually the story and its overtones belong to the early years of the 18th century. But by reading a little between the lines and by some fair interpretation, we get some very unusual and interesting thoughts for that period. It all began with Jonathan Swift, an Irish intellectual who had the same gentle feelings toward the English that have since endured. He belonged to a party that found special pleasure in criticizing and condemning the policies of the crown at that time. He succeeded in offending Queen Anne thoroughly, and also, of course, being born in the objective case, he made many enemies, but had a few tremendously devout adherents. Swift's concept of life was influenced by personal feelings and by the conditions which descended upon himself in the course of years. Being a person with a very sharp tongue and an even sharper pen, he had many adversaries. He had a genius for offending people. He also had the skill to say a lot of things that were true that no one wanted to hear. And the combination was a little detrimental to his social standing and also ultimately interfered with his career very definitely. He was working along an idea very similar to that of Daniel Defoe in his Robinson Crusoe, and later by Insel Felsenburgh, a German version. He had the idea of taking a seaman, a man of moderate intelligence, who had had 3 years of medical training, but was unable to afford the rest of the course, so he named this individual Lemuel Gulliver. Gulliver was a partly literate man, but he had the native wit and wisdom that comes from the Battle of Hard Knocks. And so when Gulliver went to sea on various ships, he kind of kept a diary. And this diary more or less supplied the information found by researchers, of course all imaginary, in Gulliver's travels. Now after the creation of the Republic in Russia, during the reign of Stalin, someone over there wrote a parody on it called Gullible's Travels. And I think it was very much in the feeling of the original subject. Other books have been parodied in the same way. For instance, we have Alice in Blunderland instead of Wonderland. These satires mostly point at social situations. And most of these books are not available easily in this country. They're long out of print. But to get back again to Gulliver's Travels, the book itself consists of four journeys which Gulliver made to different parts of the world. The last two, however, are agreed to be less interesting, less meaningful than the others. The first is interesting, curious, and psychologically significant. The second voyage, however, of Gulliver becomes the very kernel of the message that was attempted. It was in this particular part that Swift expressed his own full conviction about conditions of the time. The selection of two worlds, very imaginary, the world of the little people, the Lilliputs, and the world of the great big people, or giants, goes back to the Greek and Roman periods. Many of the early historians describe a race of midgets or little people, but never were able to quite locate them. We know now that such races of midgets do actually exist in comparative small size when likened to the normal height of the human being. We also know that in Africa there are also some gigantic tribes, giants in the more literal sense of the word, that reach six and a half or 7 feet in height as an ordinary medium. But these were legends at that time. Now, to make the legend almost more legendary, the story of Gulliver's experiences is based largely in what was called at that time Van Diemen Land. Van Diemen Land, later known as Tasmania, has since become officially called Australia. It was the oceans outside of this area where it is supposed that Gulliver got into his difficulties or had his various adventures. Now, there are two points of view in connection with this story. In one and the first, Gulliver finds himself in a world of tiny people, 6-7 inches high. These tiny people have their own world and their own problems, and he becomes a giant in a world of midgets. He becomes literally the big man. Now, as a big man, he has all kinds of adventures. The little people, first of all, don't trust him. And that might be psychologically rather simple. The more important people become, the less likely they are to be trusted, because everyone feels or thinks that advancement must be gained by some kind of unlawful means. But they are really quite certain that Gulliver is a danger. So he is cast ashore, and when he wakes up, he finds he has been tied down by little threads like cobwebs by hundreds that cover all parts of him until he seems to be in a cocoon. Around him are all these little people in a state of absolute frenzy. They have never seen anything like this before. They do not know what to do about it. They get all the help they can from their leaders, but their leaders know nothing either. So the time goes on, and finally Gulliver is able to convince these people that he's not going to hurt them. So they gradually release him, but they watch him very carefully, because they feel quite confident that he has ulterior motives. Just what they are, these people are not sure. So now we have the concept psychologically of the big person in the world of little people. We have the individual who is outstanding in some way, who rises to the surface, who becomes a dictator or a governor or a ruler, and immediately opens himself to all kinds of complications involving his subjects or those who are his followers. They want him to do things for them. In other words, if he is bountiful, they will overlook the fact that they do not care whether he is honest or not, as long as he is generous to them. This becomes the basis of what might be termed proletarian integrity. It becomes the foundation. If you can help me, if you will get me more money, if you will secure me more favors, I really am not going to question how you do it. So the more they study Gulliver, the more they decide that he can do them favors, and therefore the best thing to do is get along with him and give him plentiful opportunity to serve them in any capacity that they desire. As the story unfolds, Gulliver performs a number of very useful works for these people. He helps them to accomplish a number of ends which they want, and he cooperates with them in a battle with another little group of gnomes or little people. In one part of the story, he ties a fleet of 50 ships together and carries them off, and thereby destroys the navy that was going to invade the little world of the Lilliputs. This they've considered to be very, very good, but when peace is declared, or when they decide that all should be peace and forbidden, and Gulliver decides to visit the former enemy on a social visit, he is then declared guilty of treason, by the Lilliputs. They say that this is unfair, that peace should not be declared, that you have an enemy, you're supposed to keep him. And the longer you keep him, the better off you are. If you forgive him, if you get friendly with him, and you go into business with him, you'll ultimately be in trouble. Not necessarily because he will be dishonest, but because you will never trust him anyway. And therefore, he has no inducement to be sincere himself. So in the end of all this traveling around and doing things to help people and solving their problems for them, Gulliver is brought to court before the magistrates and sentenced to death for a traitor by the people of the little country. However, there are some benefactors present also, so they decide that they would be satisfied not to kill him at once, but slowly. This is rather an ingenious thought, and it has been done on a number of occasions, to slowly destroy someone who you are afraid of. But in height of all this emergency, an old boat floats into the area, deserted and upside down. And Gulliver, with his friends, manages to put the boat back into some kind of shape, and he sails off to salvation before he is destroyed. And he comes home to his family and has a brief time in which he tells them all about his adventures, and they all think it's perfectly wonderful, but nobody believes him. So that everything is in proper normal order by the time the adventure is over, and Swift has just begun to touch the surface of his satire. What he is really aiming at is far more complicated. And the complication is fulfilled in the second journey of Gulliver. And the second journey is his trip to the land of the giants. Now, the giants are people 8 or 10 times his own height. They're enormous, so that they can pick him up in one hand, and he becomes a doll in the hands of one of the royal princesses, and they build him a little house on a table about the size of a deck of playing cards. He is then in a world of tremendous people, and he is the little midget. Now, over this conglomerate of great giants, there rules a rather thoughtful king who is fully aware of the precariousness of his own situation and also realizes that he has tremendous influence because of the tremendous size of his people. Not their number so much, but their individual size. And they are large like this by a grace of deity. And the king of this country is a devoutly religious man. He is not one of these individuals who is attempting to be a tyrant, basically. But when he finds that he has in his household a human being from another world, a human being from a land out of sight, where people live together on a planet, where all kinds of things are happening all the time, and many different governments are being attempted. The king of this land of giants wants to share the information as to how other nations run their affairs. And this is where the cynic comes through in perfect color. He is here all the way through this dissertation. It starts out by Gulliver being asked to describe these other countries, what they look like, what the people are like, what they're doing, and the motives that inspire their action. And of course, here he has an opportunity to say all kinds of unpleasant things about prominent people in the contemporary scene. Actually, the whole story is contemporary. It all lies in the area of the first half of the 18th century. But we have to adapt it a little bit to the principles, which are much more widespread and can endure to all time. So king asks Gulliver how these countries govern themselves. Well, he says that in England, for instance, the government is in the hands of Parliament. And Parliament consists of two houses, the House of Lords and the House of Commons. The king thinks this over very carefully. He says, well, how do you elect these people? How do they get there? How do you appoint them? So Gulliver is not too certain himself, but he does the best he can with the story and tries to impress the king with the fact that it is a parliamentary procedure. And he explains that the lords represent the owners, landowners, and nobility. And the king says, well, what makes them noble? And this was a question that Gulliver had a little trouble with. Well, they come from noble families. Well, what made the families noble? Oh, they were born into nobility. Oh. Well, if they were born into nobility, how does it operate in their lives? Are these nobles because they are a superior class? Are they in all cases superior people? And if they're not, why are they governing the country? Well, it sort of stopped him for a moment. Well, he said, I guess I'll have to admit that they're not all superior people, that undoubtedly some of them are pretty good people and some are not so good. And then the king said, well, the ones that are not so good, why don't they get rid of them? Well, it's not quite that easy to get rid of these characters. Why isn't it easy? Well, after all, there's no one that can get rid of them but themselves, because they're appointed for life. And the king thought, well, he said, I don't know. I don't think I'm going to take that particular experience and do something with it. And what about this other house? Oh, that's the commons. And who are the commons? Well, the commons are the people, the public in general. Yes. And how do they elect an officer? Oh, they pick whom they think is best. Yes. Well, what motivates them to pick a certain person? Gulliver says, well, I suppose it's because they like him. Yes. Well, why do they like him? I says, well, I guess they like him because they think he's going to do things for them. The king said, that's what I thought. What are the inducements? Do these people that are elected in this way, are they tested? Are their characters examined? Do they pass examinations? Do they prove by bad conduct that they are honorable? Are they really, if they are going to be the leaders, are they really better than the people they're leading? Well, maybe in some cases, maybe in some cases, no. Well, why can't they pick them so they will be? The discussion is getting pretty serious at this point. And what are their power? Well, they have power to govern themselves in a sense. The commons make certain that the average person has a fair deal. And why didn't the lords do that? Well, they have other interests. And by the way, he says, how are these people remunerated? What do you do about paying them? Are these officials amply rewarded? Are they receiving very strong financial support? He says, well, I guess some of them are. He says, are those that are governing in either house more interested in their own advancement financially than the good of the people? I don't know. Could be either way. In other words, says the king, you are governed by people who pick themselves to govern you. Yes, I guess they do. You are being governed by people whose integrities and abilities have not been adequately determined. When you appoint a man to commons, which would be equivalent to our House of Representatives, are you picking a man of absolute integrity? Are you picking a man who couldn't be bought or sold for any price? Are you picking a man who will never associate himself with projects that are contrary to the good of his constituency? Is he going to play politics or is he going to take care of his people? Well, it's a kind of a question. We just don't know too much about some of these things. All right, the king then went on. He said, now, how about the various problems involving the people now? are all the people comfortable, well-fed, prosperous, and busy? Well, not all. Why not? If the best people in the country are governing the country, why are not all the people happy? Well, I guess some people don't want to be happy. Well, of course, that's possible, too. But has everyone an opportunity? What are you doing with your children? How do you raise children in your country? Well, they come and we grow them up in one way or another. Are they properly taught? Are they taught from the very beginning to respect their country? Are they taught that anything that they do that is dishonorable disgraces their country? Are they taught to be neat and clean and intelligent? Are they taught to gain useful trades or professions and work at them sincerely? And are they happy with a proper remuneration? Or are they out all the time trying to get something they haven't earned? Well, I guess as Gulliver, there's both kinds. Some probably fulfill your worst suspicions, and perhaps some your best hopes. So it goes on, little by little. He says, what's religion in your country? Well, we have the Church of England, and we are a Christian people. Well, what are Christian people? Well, they're people who follow the teachings of Christ. Do your leaders follow the teachings of Christ? Are they practicing whatever moral virtues that your sacred books imply? And does your clergy devote itself primarily to teaching the teachings of Christ? Or are they more interested in accumulating great wealth in their own name? Well, that's the problem. We're not too sure of some of these things. So Gulliver more or less takes the attitude, you have to hope for the best. Well, the king keeps on probing. He probes and then he takes a pad out and he writes a long list of questions so that he doesn't have to interrupt Gulliver all the way along. But in the second, third, fourth, fifth, and sixth sessions that they have, he takes up these specific points in order to try to understand exactly what the rest of the world is doing. And Gulliver says, I had an inspiration at that moment. I'd never thought of it before, but I felt that His Majesty would certainly want to know about it. Namely, that the control of countries is very largely due to the invention of gunpowder. And King says, what's gunpowder? Never heard of it. Well, he says it's some powder that if you put it into a locked metal and light it, it will fire a bullet. Or if you put it in some kind of a bomb, it will explode. And if you put it into cannons, it will blow the walls off of cities. Oh, it's a very important invention. The kings looked thought for a moment. He said, well, you know, I hope they did what they should have done with that. And what was that? Kill the man who invented it. He said, we wouldn't have anything of that kind for any consideration. And can you fit that into your religion? Do you think it's all right religiously to do things like this? Well, we all said, there's not much we can do about it. Several different countries have it, and they use it on each other. Well, that's bad. Something should be done. So perhaps you should have a ruler who can handle these things rather than allow the worst to go along all the time. Isn't there somebody among your people who could really straighten this out so that people would know what was right and what was wrong and would go accordingly? Scholar says, I'm not sure. I doubt it very seriously. And I suppose the king said, if you did have someone like that and he tried, they'd get rid of him pretty quick. Yes, I think so. Well, then how about health in your country? Are your country people good and healthy like ours? Do they get three square meals a day? Whether they're lords or commoners, they get the three square meals a day. Well, he says, I don't think all our people are well fed. I can't say that they are. Some of them certainly are having a lot of trouble and a lot of pain and a great deal of unemployment. What kind of rules do you have? What kind of a pattern are you living by? Have you got a good pattern that you're not living? Or have you got a bad pattern that you are living? What has happened to any people who have all the advantages that you've described to me in various fields of activity, who can't get along with each other? How does it happen that nations, all governed by elected leaders or born leaders, and with very elaborate means of maintaining whatever ethics they want, why are these nations enemies? Why do they not like each other? And the other, I guess, said something to the effect that it was due to ambition or covetousness. Nations want what other nations have. They want to rule over other countries. They want to have more nations under their sway. Things are too deep for me. I just can't work that out at all. If you have a world of nations, why don't they get along together pleasantly? Well, I guess they don't have the right outlook on the matter. Well, who's going to give them the right outlook? Why don't they get together and agree to do that which is right? Why do they not say these principles are true, we all believe them, therefore we will all live them and we will live happily ever afterwards? Why do we have something else? Well, I guess it's human nature, says Gulliver. Human nature is something that just doesn't change that much. Most people are ambitious. Most people want what other people have. Most people are interested in getting it by fair means or foul. King says, well, I don't think I'd like to live in those countries. I think that there must be something very wrong. Has it ever been suspected that these other countries might be ruled by insane people? that the leaders might be crazy? Why should a world be crazy unless its leaders are? Good, sane leaders don't lead crazy worlds. Therefore, if the worlds do not accomplish anything that is valuable, then there's something wrong with the way in which they are led. And there are wrong inducements. What are the ambitions? What are the purposes of the people in these countries? Well, as Gulliver said, most of them want to be rich. Most of them want to be powerful. Some of them want to be happy. King said, how many of them want to be good? I'm not so sure about that particular quantity. Most people are more interested in doing what they want to do than what they want to do. There's something wrong with the countries. There's something desperately wrong with these people. Because in your world, as you describe it, it looks like it's pretty prosperous, that everybody ought to have what is necessary. You have just as good a planet and just as good a world as we have. We're not having these troubles. So Gulliver listens and answers these various doubts to the best of his ability. But he finally has to agree with the king that the great enemies of with mankind in general are the avarices, ambitions, and conflicts of human nature. So the king says, ask how they expect to get rid of all of this, what you might term ignorance, that it's ignorance finally. Well, says, we have some awfully good schools where they can study what they ought to know. And the king says, well, are these schools teaching these people what they ought to know? Or are they simply teaching them to keep on doing what they're doing now? Well, he says, the colleges are rather conservative in our country, at least. They're more or less inclined to stay with traditional ways. They're not interested in great changes. They're not interested in any changes which bring discomfort or poverty to any group. They want all to be sat, to be happy. I said, yes, happy, but they're not. If they're all supposed to be happy, why are most of them miserable? Haven't you the right laws? Haven't you the right rules? Haven't you the means of enforcing these laws? Why do you have crime? Why do people do things that are nasty to each other? Well, they don't know any better. Or they have never found out that there was a better way. I said, you better go and take a look at your educational system then and find out what's wrong with it. There's something desperately wrong or you wouldn't be in this condition. So it goes on through a number of pages in which Gulliver and the king have long heart-to-heart discussions on what is the matter with the world. And it finally boils down to the fact that humanity is what it is and is going to remain what it is until they accept the leadership of someone that can help them to make it better. And until they learn to be honorable, they will never actually have any security. And they're going to pay for their selfishness with wars, pestilence, and poverty and crime. Now, this was in the early years of the 18th century. And, of course, most of these points were put into the terms of that day. But the substance of them was very definitely honorable and definitely constructive. These giants represented, very largely, an archetypal form of humanity. The truly great ones. The big ones, who are supposed to be responsible for the others. So in our modern world, the big ones can be almost anything. They can be giants of finance, lords of industry, or just simply wealthy leisure caste. But they are the ones, as leaders, upon whom the world depends for the advances that are necessary. Swift himself takes the ground that everything that is wrong must be corrected by the ones who are doing the wrong. That it cannot be done by someone saying, you mustn't do this. That's been attempted for ages and has led to nothing but revolt and rebellion. Each problem in which the group or the individual finds themselves in trouble presents the challenge. And while Swift doesn't go into great details on this subject, I think that the extension of his own thinking leads in this direction. That if there is trouble in any level of society, it must be worked out on that level. That it must be solved by the individuals in trouble recognizing why they are in trouble. Unless they find out for certain that the situation demands some change in their own conduct, we're not going to have any successful solutions. If some dictator demands a change and forces a change by violence, destroying a system which in his opinion is corrupt, those whom he attempts to save will shortly turn on him. Because unless the understanding is stimulated, you will not have any progress. Progress is not legislated, it is experienced. It becomes part of our daily life to learn to do things better. And if we lock ourselves to learning of this kind, we are always in trouble. Learning has at its fountainhead the school system. It is from the educational system of mankind that young people are trained for the kind of career that they are supposed to have. Now, does this system, as the king in the little story tells us, does this system teach basic integrity and place success on the level of integrity rather than advantage or some special deceit. Is education fitting the citizen for a life of integrity which will help him to demand it as a birthright and to cooperate with others of similar mind? If education is limited entirely to skill for profit, we will never have a race of leaders capable of leading a people to peace and security. It simply cannot be done. There will never be an armament strong enough to end war. There will never be laws better enough or bettered enough to bring prosperity to the 4.5 billion people who are on this planet. The only way these better things can come is through a voluntary cooperation of peoples. Each group must finally realize its interdependence and work with all other groups to make all legitimate advantage of the opportunities and resources of the planet. Unless this is done, it's just not going to solve itself. It's going to keep right on getting worse and worse. Now, to get worse means it gets more painful. There are more people out of work. The problem of housing and homes becomes more difficult. Food shortages arise, and exceptional and unreasonable profits burden those who are already heavily burdened. All of these situations represent what to the king of the giants in the story represents completely irrational behavior. The world is made up of madmen, if that is the best they can do. And if they cannot do better than this, then there is no hope for them. If they cannot cure their own ailments, then heaven must come in and change things. It must take away from leadership those who are not fit to lead, and release from leadership those who can live better without it. So the whole problem lies in the recognition that the individual, whether he be an intellectual or a tradesman or a craftsman or a worker in a factory, must be a prophet to the system to which he belongs. He must be right. He must be a unit of integrity in the great structure of things. If we do not have enough units of integrity, no good laws can be enforced. And the answer to why are we not doing this probably goes back far beyond anything that Gulliver talked about or that the author of Gulliver had in mind. Actually, at the basis of our lives, at the beginnings and foundations of all things, we have a humanity in common. This humanity has endowed all of us with similar attitudes, similar aptitudes, similar potentials. Every human being is a unit capable of education and discipline, with a few exceptions of cases of accidental births or disablements. Nearly all human beings can become better. They can grow, they can learn more, they can be more understanding, and they can be more thoughtful and sympathetic in their relations with each other. This is blocked by one circumstance: the desperate desire of each individual to have all that he can for himself. And yet, if we analyze the whole business, if we took every dollar that there is on the planet and all the potential wealth on the planet and divided it evenly among all peoples, very few would be any happier than they are now. Because as one parody years ago pointed this out, that at the end of the division, a few people bought some cheap toys and gadgets, and immediately the others lost all their money buying things they didn't need, and the economic system was right where it was before. the people didn't know. So here we have, back in the days of Sparta and all these times, desperate efforts to try to find a common denominator for the human problem. Gulliver was of the opinion that this human problem could only be solved when it became too uncomfortable for too large a part of the population. When everybody is miserable, then something has to be happening, because now we have something in common, even if it's only a disaster. If we all have the common disaster, we're going to work our way out of it. But as long as most of the people do not feel the disaster, or are able to be paid off by some little favor now and then, the disaster will ultimately set in. So we can only assume that the king in the story of Gulliver was sounding at the very foundations of modern civilization. The dean, as he was called, Dean Swift, was expressing all of his own animosities and antagonisms through the argument between Gulliver and the king. Swift finally ended up by retiring again to Ireland, where he became a dean of one of the churches over there and lived in reasonably comfortable disrespectability for the rest of his life. Up to the very end, he was a voice of dissension crying in the wilderness. He couldn't understand why people didn't like him. Why? Very obvious. Any individual who interferes with what we want to do is not likable to us. We think he should be immediately converted to our point of view or kicked out, one or the other. Also, as time goes on, we discover, as in the story of Gulliver and the Little People, that we cannot depend upon a situation in which those who need help do not know what they need, why they need it, and how they should get it. As long as we have poverty, there should be education to teach us to get over it. And it should be very definitely an honorable policy. As long as there is crime, some way virtue has to be established. Now, there are ways sometimes in which religion can step in on these problems. So Gulliver has a little something to do about that also.